All right, welcome to the panel today, Hypervigilance in Post-Mormon Communities. The presenter is John Larson, who holds a BA in Linguistics from BYU and an MBA from WSU. Is that Weber State?
Weber State.
Nice.
Great.
He is a former host of the Mormon Expression podcast and the current executive director of the Whitefields Educational Foundation, and is a project manager at the University of Utah Hospital. So if you would please hold your questions till the presentation is over, and please turn your cell phones on silent. So, John.
Thank you.
Actually, you can ask questions whenever you want.
Fine.
So, thanks for coming. PTSD, over the past few years I've been working very closely with therapists trying to find resources and counseling and classes and other elements for ex-Mormons. As I've done a lot of work in the community, I've realized that based on a lot of people talking to me and my own struggles, my own observations, that it's not an easy thing to do to struggle around with one's identity. There's a strong disagreement, especially among non-clinical people. And I should give a disclaimer. I'm not a therapist, licensed or otherwise. So I'm just talking about my own observations, opposed to real diagnosis of what is a real and serious condition. But PTSD, years ago, it really was first known as shell shock, and they noticed that soldiers coming back from these high intense situations would suffer long-term effects of it. And myself, like everyone else, I've heard about it, and I actually have memories. I was born, we were talking about, in 1973, which is, I was actually born on the day the last American was killed in Vietnam on January 27th. And so I grew up being exposed to Vietnam vets, and there were some things that we all knew about them. Like, they liked to sit with their back to the back wall. So if you were ever around them in restaurants, they would sit with their back, and they would flinch at loud noises and stuff like that. I had a cousin. He unfortunately died fairly young. I have a big Mormon family, and I'm at the tail end. So, and he was a machine gunner in Vietnam, and he was the nicest guy, but you could, and I never saw him do anything violent or anything like that, but I do distinctly remember him flinching when loud noises would go off, like on the 4th of July. And so my point is, we've been exposed to PTSD, and PTSD is something that we tend to associate with those highly traumatic events that obviously soldiers and people like that suffer from. A couple years ago, I think there was an online discussion, and there was some talk about PTSD, and somebody came in and said, hey, if you haven't been in a war, you can't have PTSD. Like, the symptoms are a function of how serious the externality of the event that you go through are. And what I would argue is, as I've looked at it more, it's not really a function of what happens in a sort of outside of you, it's really how you process it. So two people can go through the same event, and one can come out completely unscathed, and the other one can have serious repercussions. Viktor Frankl, in his fantastic book, what's the book called? Man's Search for Meaning. Thank you. He talks about this. He's dealing. He was himself a Holocaust survivor, and he was dealing with a lot of people in terms of their experience following the Holocaust, and talked about the suffering and the experience wasn't really expressly connected to how severe their trauma was. It was how they internally processed it. So I became more aware of it acutely on a personal level when I went through my own divorce. And my divorce was amicable, but it was very difficult for me. And it wasn't until I had been going through therapy that my therapist suggested, well, you're manifesting some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress on a very small level. So, and it was something that I started reading about a little bit more, and I started becoming attuned to. Major stress or anxiety in the literature, they generally talk about triggering this sort of thing. And those things are like terrorism, death, threat of violence, and fear, a lot of fear, which we'll come back to in a minute. So when you, if you remember, like post 9/11 in the United States, there was a lot of these sort of things that started manifesting themselves in the way people were interacting with each other, the way they were watching the news, and even in a short term, we started seeing some of those symptoms come out on a bigger scale. And that's sort of what I want to talk about. One of the symptoms of PTSD is hypervigilance. Now, there is a hypervigilant disorder, again, I'm not a therapist, that can manifest potentially from other things besides PTSD, but I just wanted to make that connection early. So we're really going to kind of narrow down on hypervigilance and what it is and how it manifests in these communities. Hypervigilance, sometimes identified as hyperarousal, commonly the fight or flight syndrome. So most of us will experience this sort of high anxiety in very short doses, and you could argue that there's a strong evolutionary component of it. When you find yourself in danger, you know, adrenaline and other elements will go up, so you're ready to fight. Things like your pain threshold will go up. You'll have more sudden bursts of energy, and there's real elements to it that if you're on your life is on the line and it comes down to biting and scratching and crawling and gouging or whatever, you're ready for it. But what normally happens is you're in that hyper-aroused state, and then that state diminishes and you return to a normal. But there seems to be an element with some individuals where this state of hyper-arousal doesn't go away. It stays. And that's often as we talk about PTSD. Hypervigilance itself manifests as preoccupation with threats, particularly unknown threats. So when I talk about my Vietnam vet friends who want to sit in the back of the restaurant so they can scan everything, there is this element of there is some threat out there. There's people that I don't know. There's something could be happening on the street. And even though logically you can say, what's the likelihood of a shooter in Applebee's on a Tuesday night? That sort of thought pattern doesn't run because it's happening kind of below that conscious processing level. So the hypervigilant individual will have a preoccupation with unknown threats in particular. They will be constantly watching and scanning their surroundings, especially those who have experienced violence in particular. They're looking for that threat of violence. And there is a persistent sense of insecurity, that something is not quite right. I'm not okay the way I am right now. Something has got to change. But where this disorder sort of plays out is rather than somebody who is scared of a home invasion, and then they go and put, you know, like from the sitcoms where you put like 9 locks on your door and then suddenly you sleep at night. For the hypervigilant individual, that wouldn't work. That because the threat is felt as a non-directed manifestation. There's just some threat out there and it's going to get me. Of course, these things, I'm talking about it in general, that it could become very specific and very focused. And that's why PTSD and hypervigilance can oftentimes lead to violence. Like we see an elevation of, say, domestic violence for soldiers coming home. They've been used to scanning the environment looking for IEDs or other sort of violence that way. They get home, they get into a heated argument with their spouse, and then they become violent. And it's a spillover from their previous traumatic situation. Where there's something that kind of messes with that ability to cope because that anxiety level and that sense of threat is elevated. So here, this is from WebMD, I think. People suffering from hypervigilance may become preoccupied with studying their environment for possible threats, which causes them to lose connection with their family and friends. They will overreact to loud and unexpected noises or become agitated in highly crowded or noisy environments. They will oftentimes have difficulty getting to sleep or staying asleep. And the thing I want to focus in there is that losing connection because they're preoccupied with the threat, right? So my Vietnam friend in Applebee's has a hard time enjoying the meal because he can't get out of his mind that he needs to know where everybody is all the time. He needs to know what the situation is. For a lot of years, I worked a couple years directly at the police department. For a lot of years, I worked with cops for like 7 or 8 years. So I've worked with a lot of police officers all over the United States, and I've seen this manifest in them because they tend to view things as potentially violent situations. Like they're, and this is why we see the escalation, and you see all these videos now of police officers going to what should be benign traffic stops, but then escalating out of control. And a lot of this comes from this same psychological element, where all of those encounters for that officer are seen as a potential threat, so they become explosive. So in my career, or however you want to call it, with ex-Mormons, I've had the fortune or misfortune of hearing probably 1,000 exit stories from people who want to share them with me. And I noticed something a few years ago. When people are telling me their stories, their respiration rate will increase. They'll become flushed. They'll oftentimes take on the 10-mile stare. So they're talking to me, but they're undirected where their eyes are looking. They definitely become angry. They become agitated, even to a point that they don't realize. And if you try to sort of talk them down, sometimes they'll snap because they might be telling a story about their mother, but they don't realize that they're becoming increasingly angry. And just exhibiting that increased like blood pressure and like something very terrible is happening. So I became tuned in the fact that something is going on here, right? This isn't just that they were upset that they had to leave the church, because oftentimes their story was meandering and wandering. It didn't make sense to anybody else but them, but they were clearly experiencing an internal visceral reaction to what they were talking about. So let's talk about this sort of PTSD and leaving the church. Because I've seen this argument before, saying, well, can the idea of moving beyond a particular religious view, where nobody's shooting at you, and very few people have experienced any sort of violence, can that, in fact, propel somebody into the same symptom bubble of PTSD? And what I would say is, if one takes the teachings of the church literally, I think it's a mark of the sort of stereotypical angry ex-Mormon. If you want to find something that's a uniting factor, is that they were the people who actually really believed Mormonism. I've met a lot of people who walked away from the church, and you know, some of them say, their beliefs, they just never, you know, they would drink coffee or they would do whatever they did because they didn't take it very serious. But the stronger the ex-Mormon's personality is, it's oftentimes because they really did believe it. And if you really do buy it, you know, all of it together, leaving the church is much worse of a threat than, say, dying, right? If you're, say, a priesthood holder, and of course this is up for a debate, but you could potentially be facing down outer darkness, which is sort of like, imagine the worst thing you can, now multiply it by 10, and times that by a million, and that's outer darkness, right? That's sort of the teaching. The most terrible thing possible that could happen to any person. And here is an individual, oftentimes out of good faith, I think in most cases, good faith, struggling with their own testimony, struggling with their own sense of identity and what's right and what's wrong. So they're going through that. And at the same time, the threat is, if you screw this one up, buddy, you might have a few short years of happiness here, but eternity of suffering awaits you. So for people who take that seriously, that threat to them, I think, is potentially worse in a way than the physical threat that somebody could face in battle. Now, that's kind of squishy because, like I said, there's a lot of people who can go through this process and not process it mentally that way. And that's why it'd be easy to diminish the what I think are real symptoms of hypervigilance and PTSD that people leaving the church face, because 9 out of 10 don't. So you'd say, well, no, you were never in a foxhole. You know, you just stopped paying tithing, stopped going to church. You should be celebrating that, right? You had this wonderful, fun life, so why would you experience that as any sort of PTSD? But I think that's, I'm ignoring the internalized belief of what they're doing to themselves, which is potentially losing their family, losing their children, losing their spouse, losing their eternal salvation, and suffering an eternity of pain and suffering. So I think the case can be drawn that PTSD can be a real element. But I don't want to really talk about, this is all as a matter of introduction, I don't really want to diagnose individuals with PTSD or hypervigilance. What I want to talk about is hypervigilance as a characteristic of the communities themselves. And I've noticed this manifesting itself many times as I've looked at or interacted with these communities, that, or even, let's say, something like a party. that let's say there's five friends who I know who are well-adjusted not exhibiting these symptoms. And then they circle up and they start talking about something. And then collectively, they will start manifesting the symptoms of sort of hypervigilance when it comes to the church. And sometimes those visceral reactions, the quickened breath, the flushed faces, the real anger. And you start saying, well, I know these people. I know they don't behave in a hypervigilant manner when they're outside of this particular environment. But when they get around each other, they're starting to do so. So there's some latency somewhere inside them that's bringing up these communities, that's getting brought up in these communities. Then the question sort of started asking, well, can these symptoms or can this this pattern of thought be a characteristic of the community in and of itself? That's where I sort of landed here. So communities themselves set normative behaviors. That's sort of the one of the roles of a community. And I think we have an evolutionary drive to seek out those. We human beings are social animals, and we really don't function very well independently. We all like to imagine that we're really independent, but we're not nearly as much as we are. And we decide what's okay, what's ethical, what's moral, what are boundaries, what's acceptable behavior and what's not, based on what others around us do. So one of the things that a community standard set is what it's okay to talk about and what it's not okay to talk about. What breaches protocol? What can you say to men? What can you say to women? What can you say to children? These sort of values tend to be vested in a community. And if you're doing an anthropological study and go from community to community, you'll find that these things move around. Like what's sexual taboo in one community might not be in the other. Or what's okay to do in front of children might be in one and not in the other. For example, in our Mormon culture, we're really hyper-tuned into swear words and breasts when it comes to children, exposing that to them, but not so much violence. I saw this little ad on Facebook from me the other day. It was a clean flicks sort of thing, and it said, "This movie cleaned up for your family," and the picture was American Sniper. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I haven't seen this movie, but this is about a guy that goes and like shoots people in the head, right? So to me, like, he's assassinating people. I daresn't use the word murder because I can't put moral judgment on it. But what he's doing is extreme act of violence. He's putting a bullet through somebody's head. I would much rather have my 11-year-old boy staring at a pair of tatas than contemplating the moral efficacy of sitting on the side of a hill and putting a bullet through somebody's head. That's beyond an 11-year-old's ability to morally process. Breasts are globules of fat underneath the skin, right? So I just use that example that we distort our own particular views. So when you have these communities that are forming on the edge of the church, they have their own particular values. And what's interesting is individuals, like we all do, we code shift, to borrow the term from linguistics, we move around. So the way you talk to your coworkers is different than the way you talk to your friends, different than the way you talk to family. And from a linguistic perspective, it's actually different. You will change your vocabulary. You will change your cadence. You will change. If you start talking to somebody in the South, you will start elongating your vowels the same way they do in an unperceptible way that the linguist can measure, but you have no idea you're doing. I only use that example to say we really have a tendency to adopt the values and the way everybody else around us is interacting. So there's a particular problem in this community building because of this manifestation of this hypervigilance, and we're going to go through some examples that I have four examples in particular where it manifests. Because it becomes a characteristic of the community, you basically have a community that ostensibly is there to provide community support for people who need it. One of the difficulties in leaving the church is, as a good Mormon, if you're really involved, you'll find that almost all of your time, your family, your social network, your friends, your relationship with children is taken up by the church. So what a lot of individuals experience when they leave the church is a stripping away of all of their social structure in a way that can manifest extremely negatively. So they then reach out, oftentimes online, and find these communities and say, oh, there's a bunch of people in your neighborhood who've left. Just like, we're having a party on Friday night. Bring some liquor. And what the individuals have is they have just manifest this, I don't have anybody to watch. Sally down the street used to watch my children, and now she's not available. I don't even know how to find a babysitter without asking the young women's president. I don't know, you know, we were going to go to the temple with my spouse on Friday night. Now I have no idea what we're supposed to do. And it can be in this real sort of way. The problem is that people, because these elements like hypervigilance that show up in these communities quite a bit, individuals will tend to move and eschew these communities because they have these sort of things that happen. I mean, I've joked about how people tell me their story because that's their connection they have to me. They know we both have left Mormonism, and that becomes their new identity because their old identity was stripped. It's gone. That I'm no longer a Mormon, I'm an ex-Mormon. Well, what's an ex-Mormon? An ex-Mormon is somebody who left the church. So I'm going to tell you my story of leaving the church because that's the kernel of building a new identity. That's the seed of it. And there's nothing else around that. But what we need in this new identity is a validation. And validation comes from constantly, repeatedly, over and over again, proving that the church was true and validating the decision to leave the church, which has had such a huge impact on their lives and the lives of people around them. And I think that second element of the lives of people around them is more of a driver. Because when I left the church, you know, I'd been thinking about it for years and years and years. I was ready to go. But my mother hadn't. And it was a shock to her. And I had no language to communicate with her what I was feeling that wasn't considered by her culture, which is not to blame for her, violent towards her. There was no way for me to express my feelings that wouldn't be perceived as a cultural and linguistic violence towards her own worldview. So then if I went to these parties with a bunch of well-adjusted people who generally wouldn't be suffering from PTSD, then we can get there and we can tear these things down. So where does the hypervigilance fit in? Well, the communities themselves, especially the online communities, have an immediate sort of impact where they're talking about their own stories and talking about their own experience. But that transaction happens very briefly, and then it goes away. Now this community is formed. It's an online group of friends in Boise who have all left the church together. So the community, being on Facebook, whatever, only exists when somebody's typing something in. If everybody stops typing, the community, this virtual community, ceases to exist, right? So everybody shared their story. Now what? Well, what the community is doing is it's constantly looking for the next thing. And that's where this hypervigilance comes in. The community itself as a glue to keep the community together, because the community hasn't formed on anything else. What healthy ex-Mormons do is they go find a new community. They join the arts community, or they join a bowling league, or they take up cycling, or whatever, and they'll form new friendships and communities around that. In 95% of the cases, that's what happens. And then increasingly, they'll be like, yeah, I used to be a Mormon. Because it's not something that preoccupies their thoughts. But the communities themselves, if you think about it as an entity, have nothing else to preoccupy their thought. And if anybody posts something to say, hey guys, I discovered that if you ride a bicycle, it's really fun, it won't get any comments and it will just disappear. But what will get comments is this, what's happening and what's about to happen. And that's where the hypervigilance comes. So we talk about hypervigilance as scanning for unknown threats. In particular, the unknown threats, I think, are really interesting. And so let's go through some examples. I'll start with one that's really disheartening, but was really common. The ex-Mormons on online communities, which I tend to try to stay very clear of, but sometimes they pop under my radar for various reasons. Partly because they're triggering for me, for various reasons. But there was a big sort of meme, or whatever we want to call this thing, around that President Monson has Alzheimer's. Now, if you think about this from an ex-Mormon perspective, why do you care? Like, the fact that this elderly man may or may not have Alzheimer's does neither prove nor disprove the church in any way. I can think of very few people whose testimony would in fact be impacted by the fact that a man approaching his 90s who is in charge of the church has Alzheimer's. It has no proof value for discussing that the church is unhealthy, that it is wrong, that it is right, that it is anything. It's a man who has Alzheimer's, right? Now, if he's in early stages of Alzheimer's, what's the church's interest in a perfectly upfront way of announcing that? It's a private deal, for one thing. You know, we don't normally go talk about people's health conditions or mental health conditions. He is functioning as he does. So what I'm saying is, you could construct, and they did, vast conspiracies of the church going way around the line to cover up the fact that President Monson might have Alzheimer's. But so what? Like, the church and members of the church revere the man. He's beloved to them, and they don't want him to suffer. They don't want his reputation to be appalled by the fact that people might be talking about him having Alzheimer's, right? So why did this become such a topic? And for almost a year, it's probably still out there, in a lot of ex-Mormon communities, there was Alzheimer's Watch. Every time there got to be another rumor or another innuendo or some other piece of information, it would go up and it would light up Reddit and it would light up Facebook and there would be all this discussion on it. And who the fuck cares? Well, the only reason they care is because the community itself is looking for these elements. This is that hypervigilance. Is it a threat? I don't know. It's not. But the community itself doesn't know. It's just looking for anything that can possibly validate that worldview that falls into the web of what they're identifying. These sort of conspiracy theories. They're not conspiracy theories in the way, you know, aliens or whatever, but they follow the same manifestation. There's always new evidence, you know, and you dismiss the one, oh, President Monson can't even talk, and then conference come and he would talk. Oh, well, they have big words on the teleprompter. You know, like, there's always these explanations as to why this thing, but there's no explanation as to why this matters at all, other than somehow it's negative news for the church. Ex-Mormon sex scandals. I've mentioned these before, and they're fascinating to me that they come up from time to time. The question is why. Ex-Mormons are supposed to be really libertine, right? They're supposed to be out there, like, experiencing the world. We all joke and talk about how ex-Mormons go through their rumspringa. So why are there sex scandals amongst ex-Mormons about behavior between consenting adults? And that's what I'm referring to, that there's been more than one of these where consenting adults perform some sex act, maybe publicly or semi-publicly or whatever they do, but it causes these huge rifts of groups and innuendos and all this stuff that they want to talk about it all the time. I think this is another example of the hypervigilance. These communities are set, and they're waiting, and they're pulsing, waiting for something to happen. And then you get something that has no bearing whatsoever on the church at all. But because the knives are out, as soon as something happens here, they just spin around and they've got their knives drawn, right? And I believe that is, again, a manifestation of this this hypervigilant attuneness to threat. Now, we could dissect that a little bit more and say, why is that a threat? And it's partly a threat because I think sexuality is a difficult thing to navigate in this world anyway, but when suddenly you've spent 20 or 30 or 50 years in the church being dictated exactly what you're supposed to do, exactly what's out and what's not, and suddenly all barriers break down, that you know how not to get pregnant, you know kind of how not to get an STD, and all that, and then really you can do anything you want? Dear Jesus, that's scary. Right? So I think that's where this sort of thing, it's this threat suddenly that here I am at this party and, you know, Steve is making out with Sally, who's married to Jim, and Jim's sitting over there smiling. We just don't know how to process that. And we process it by going and trying to explode it somewhere else on the internet. And I think it becomes from that element of this is a threat. I'm uncomfortable with it. It's somehow a threat. I don't understand how it's a threat, but we're going to make it so. We're going to discuss it. Tom Phillips case, well, I think was a fantastic example and probably right square in the middle of what I'm talking about with this hypervigilance. You all remember Tom Phillips from, was it this January or was it 2 years ago? I'm getting older, time's going a lot faster. The older you get, faster time goes. But Tom Phillips, of course, was a area authority in England. And he'd gone under a pseudonym. I think John DeLinda interviewed him. for a long time went on the pseudonym of the Anointed One. So he, being an area authority in that high level of church, he had actually gone through his second anointing, and then he became disenfranchised and left the church. Well, so he developed a certain amount of notoriety and celebrity in ex-Mormon circles because of that. Well, then in the fall of, I guess it was 2013, he started hinting at there was something big coming. Something big coming. And then every time he would do that, or one of his close, he had a couple of friends who would keep saying, something's coming. Tom's got something big. Just you wait. It's coming. And it became known in the circles as the October surprise. Because they had announced, somebody had, who knows who announced, that's part of this whole thing. Where did it come from? I don't know, it's rumors. That there was going to be a big announcement in October. And so they would just keep talking and talking and talking about the October surprise. Was there any news? No. But this hypervigilance of this threat, and the threat to the church is sort of what triggers this thing. If there's going to be something that is going to be damaging to the church, it's a threat to this status, and they would tune in on it. October came and went, nothing happened, and then it would just keep popping up and popping up and popping up. In January, following that, then the story broke that he was filing a lawsuit against the church in British courts, and he basically said, I think they're committing a fraud under British law, and he cited things like the story of Adam and Eve. Where the story became interesting is at that point, once he came forward, there were several of us, I was one of them, who came out and said, this case doesn't have merit. And I wrote my essay on it, and I said, the case doesn't have merit because we don't want to live in this world. We want free speech. People should be free to believe in Adam and Eve if they want. They shouldn't be thrown in prison for that. You know, it's a silly belief, but there shouldn't be legal repercussions. And boy, I got a lot of hate mail. And a lot of the hate mail accused me of basically not following orthodoxy, of saying, why are you disloyal to the ex-Mormon cause? And I would say, what ex-Mormon cause? There is no ex-Mormon cause. There's just people. But it's not that they were, I mean, to some extent they were taking a paradigm of orthodoxy and doing that elsewhere. But it was this hyped up hypervigilance that came in the community where they were scanning entirely for anything that would promote this case up, as if posting this in the ex-Mormon subreddit was somehow influencing the British courts or something. I'm not exactly sure how that mindset works, but there is these elements of clicktivism that comes in today. Clicktivism is sort of a neologism that there's general activism, and then there's all this stuff on the internet, and the downside of it is people think they're doing something if they post something. So some children get kidnapped in Africa and they'll post articles about it and feel like they're contributing somehow. So I think that there's a powerlessness that comes for people who leave the church, who then have a real impact in their life. They lose these community connections we talked about, and they want to do something. But very few people will go out and, I don't know, say, build a community center for ex-Mormons or whatever. That's an extremely rare thing. But what they can do is they can post in-your-face articles on Facebook every day so that everyone can see it. And that community element of doing that starts to develop in this hyper-vigilant thing of watching everything that's going on. Where Tom Phillips, there was not a story there. And then the courts looked at it and said, this is silly, and dismissed it. And that's the way the world processed it. This kind of quacky guy comes and posts, does this frivolous lawsuit. The lawsuit 3 weeks later gets dismissed. But from the ex-Mormon world, it was this constant buzz and strum and drang for months and months and months because of this community aspect I'm talking about. The last one I want to talk about is conference, because I think it's a really good illustration. I've been told by a lot of ex-Mormons that they never watched conference, they left the church. You know, at conference that comes on in the fall and in the... And if you go into ex-Mormon circles, if you go to like ex-Mormon Facebook groups, they are dissecting real-time conference talks sentence by sentence by sentence. And you say, wait a minute, Mormons don't even do this. Why are you guys doing this? Why are you subjecting yourself? Like, we'll say one of the worst things about Mormonism is 10 hours of conference, right?
I think we all can agree with that. That's the single worst thing about Mormonism. And yet ex-Mormons will go and watch the whole goddamn thing month after month after month, where they never would have done it when they were Mormons at all, right? And that's this community thing, because they're getting immediate feedback from their community in a way they never got with Mormons. Like, can you imagine, like, sitting in your backyard with all your Mormon neighbors and watching conference and talking about it real time? That's what these guys are doing. They're processing it real time, because the community being hyper-vigilantly focused on what are they going to say next. And the same, back when I was a kid, you know, there would always be the rumors come up, and it was always the same rumor. I don't know about for you guys. This year, they're going to change the block from 3 hours to 2 hours. This is the year it's going to happen. The two-hour block is coming. I can feel it. I got a brother who works in the church office building, and that would come about every 2 years. And then I noticed that it was happening among the ex-Mormons too. Even that same rumor would be posted in ex-Mormon communities. It's going to go to two. It's going to go to 2 hours. You don't go to church. Why do you care if it goes to 2 hours? But that's because they're looking for the threat. That's what I'm saying. That hypervigilant sense that something is happening engages them. The same way our friend, the Vietnam vet, would scan Applebee's. This is the ex-Mormon version of scanning Applebee's. They're going to listen to every talk because they're looking for elements to validate themselves and their position. And they're looking for elements that show that there is a real threat. And any little sentence that can be misconstrued or blown up or taken out of context in a way that favors the ex-Mormon view will be done. Not that they don't say terrible things in conference from time to time, but the ex-Mormons are waiting and watching because of this hypervigilance. So what is to be done about this? Because this is a huge problem for community building outside of the church and in terms of creating these communities. And it's a huge problem for those who try to build bridge communities, which in the abstract I admire. You know, John Dillon, his work is constantly, nice guy John is constantly trying to get ex-Mormons and Mormons to dialogue. But the problem is this sort of thing, which when the groups see each other as a real threat, there's no way they're going to be able to eat funeral potatoes together. And building the community and not having it diverge to this hypervigilance on is something really terrible or really fantastically good from an ex-Mormon perspective about to happen in the church can poison these, because a lot of the people we need to help do these things, to be community leaders and to help provide an example of how to raise kids outside the church and just the reassurance saying you don't need the church as much as you think you do. There's a lot of resources out there. That voice tends to get drowned out in this manifestation of this disorder of the community. And again, I'm not pointing fingers at the individuals, because if you got the individuals alone, they don't manifest this. They don't talk like this. They don't think like this. It's only in the mobocratic environment of these post-Mormon and ex-Mormon communities. So I think we have to try to create structures, but the challenge is the ex-Mormons tend to be very anti-authoritarian and anti-structure, for good reason. They've been burned by structure, right? If you've been excommunicated, if you've been dragged before a board of 15 men and had them talk about, you know, your oral sex habits, you get a little bit nervous about talking in front of a bunch of authoritative men. So the anti-authoritarian modes, unfortunately, give us a barrier to trying to create the structures that could be about just something completely positive, i.e., child rearing or how to find babysitters or stuff like that. And we have to find ways to cut through this and create communities that don't have it. One of the problems is moderation. And since these communities are virtual, the only way to keep them from going to the lowest common denominator of communication is to moderate them. But moderation meets with a big backlash in our community. And I've known lots of people who have done moderation of these communities and then get really burned and then run away from it. And I guess the appeal is that the communities themselves need to be able to back up the moderation policies of the particular groups and realize that radical free speech, i.e. anonymous people can say anything they want, anywhere they want, about anything they want, that idea needs to go aside. because what the church does effectively is creates a safe structure in which family environments and children and whatnot can be discussed without worrying about this externality stuff. Ex-Mormon communities are terrible at this. If you bring your kids to, you know, a family picnic, there's a real concern. I don't think it's legitimate, but it's a real concern that anything could happen in front of kids at any point because there's no established structure saying this is out of order. So these communities themselves have grown organically, but we have to find a way to impose structure on communities saying, you know what, this is not okay. This community does not have that, without it exploding and somebody saying, get your patriarchy off me or whatnot. And it's a problem that I do not have a solution to. It's been attempted by a lot of people, and there's a lot of people still working on the problem, but it is a tough nut to crack. And I guess the only appeal is if we can acknowledge that these sort of characteristics, A, are manifest of the communities themselves, the way they are right now, B, they're not the problem of people. It's not like this person's a bad person, or this person's a bad person, this person's a bad person. It's a problem of the community itself. So we won't get anywhere by laying the blame and saying, why did you start this thread? Or why did you post this thing? That's not the problem. And then C, we need to find ways to create these sort of safe places, these environments where we know this sort of stuff's not going to happen, to allow people to come forward. And we need everyone to do that. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on hypervigilance in the communities. I wanted to leave the last 15 minutes to hear your thoughts or your questions or concerns. So, yes, sir.
So, if you're a TVN, you're threatened by the acts of the fringe Mormon. To some degree, you're threatened by the TVN. That's what you're saying. There's no common ground because one guy thinks that the guy is ignorant, the other guy thinks that the guy has gone out the anti-Mormon side of the way. Where we've already placed a framework around both parties without actually getting somewhere in the middle to have a conversation with both either of them.
It's an interesting question. The question is on, well, you know, TBMs feel threatened by ex-Mormons. And ex-Mormons feel threatened by believing Mormons. And so what's the middle ground? How do we resolve that? I think what's interesting here, because I'm accusing the ex-Mormon communities of displaying these PTSD sort of hypervigilant, but the Mormons don't. I say they don't. The communities don't have the same sort of thing. Why not? That's an interesting question. And I think the reason is because they have structure and they have a narrative around ex-Mormons, which is something ex-Mormons kick against. We all know that if you leave the church, there's probably somebody going to say he really wanted to sin, or he was offended, right? That those narratives, not everybody says those, but those narratives are common enough. What those narratives give is they give contextualization. Then I don't have to worry about why Brother Smith, who was such an inspiration to me, left the church, because I know why he left the church. He was offended or he wanted to sin. I don't have to spend any brain power on it. So I'm not going to feel any trauma from it. I'm not going to feel any emotional reaction to it. So the Mormons have these structures, which can be a social violence to ex-Mormons in a real sort of way. Inadvertently, they don't know they're doing it, nor do they have any vindictiveness behind it. It's just what they've been trained to do. Ex-Mormons don't have that structure, so they thrash. And that's where they exhibit these sort of unhealthy manifestations. How do you get them together? That's a problem. I don't even want to tackle that problem. I'm just trying to get them in their own healthy spaces individually. How they get together is a tough one. Yes, sir. Ma'am, sorry.
The church teaches following the prophet, the humanism of God, follow the spirit, things like that. I wonder if what you're seeing as seeking out threats is more a manifestation of an inability to trust yourself and your own insights and your seeking confirmation externally, whereas before they were just told what to do by their leaders or by the spirit or whatever was influenced or not.
I think it's a really great point. What she said is that in the church, you know, you're taught to follow the spirit, you're taught to follow the leaders, you're taught to follow the church, and then you get out into the world, and you don't have those structures anymore. And there's a period where I think in the long run, in a healthy perspective, you learn to figure out who you're going to follow, what authorities, and you learn to trust your own instinct and to be true to yourself. But there's a period, and before you get there, where you kind of don't know. So what you're doing, if I take what you're saying right, is you're kind of turning that on the church. You're, rather than, so the church authority gave you meaning and purpose in life. Now they don't, but the meaning and purpose of life whole is taken up by dismissing, tearing down, and belittling the authority structure that you before had. Is that where you're going?
Well, no, it's more like, I mean, I feel like the church is a really good job of helping you figure out how to ignore your gut, so you don't trust your own thoughts and your own instincts and things like that. And so instead of turning toward a prophet or a bishop or whomever, when you have an idea or you don't have an idea, you don't know what to do, they take those ideas and they still shift it externally, but instead of going to prayer or to a leader, they're turning to these online communities and saying, please validate these ideas because I'm not sure if they're valid myself.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So what she clarified is saying, you know, the church not only gives you authority, but teaches you to not trust your own self. If your feelings are in conflict with the authority, you're wrong. So now you come out of the church and you don't have a structure to really even navigate your own feelings. You don't trust your own feelings because you've been taught for years not to. And so you this community then is giving you a structure around that. But the structure is not around any sort of positive affirmation of a value. The structure is only around saying, see, those guys over there were wrong. Yes, sir?
Yeah, because when you're taught all your life to be suspicious of your own inspiration but never question those in authority, it does create that dissonance. A couple of points. I think for those of us that were raised up in the heart of shame and fear and Mormonism and how reward, heaven, God, all of those things were presented, you know, God's undecided about you, and until you get up there and the books open, then God will decide whether or not you get to keep the things you love or he sends you to some basement kingdom. You grow up with something called complex PTSD, which is far more pernicious than PTSD. And many people in this room who are struggling with PTSD probably are really struggling with complex PTSD, and you ought to look that up. The second point, when you've had that fear, I have so many people in my life who are so determined that the leaders of the church are not going to tell them what to do anymore. So they live in this hyper-vigilant defense as if Thomas Monson and a bunch of guys were going to show up in suits on the door and say, this is what you can have for breakfast. And so what they end up doing is building a moat around their life, around their person. And they fill that moat with alligators, anger, and judgment, and they're hyper-vigilant looking for anything to attack that might come. And because nobody's going to come to their door and tell them how to live their life, they stay in that high state of anxiety because they figure, hey, it works. Nobody's told me what to do. But they've got the thinking wrong in their head.
Yeah, so two great points to the latter one first, that ex-Mormons, you know, leave, and they've had this authority structure, and then, as you say, they build a moat around their environment to protect themselves from this danger, almost this threat that a lot of people think is coming. I've been asked many, many times, I resigned in 2012, but the church never, they didn't give two shits about me. And I never worried that they would. But there were a lot of people who did nothing, even on the scale of what I did, and they were worried. So you talk about moat filled with alligators of anger, and just waiting for the people to come. And you'll see ex-Mormons who will post saying, you know what happened to me last night? Sister Smith brought over brownies. Can you imagine brownies? And they're like, yeah, how dare they? They're brownies. You know, Now, I mean, let's be clear. The reason we react that way in part is because we know what's behind those brownies. They don't. The suspicion, the hypervigilance, is we think those brownies aren't genuine, right? That they want something. But that's hypervigilance. Because otherwise you'd say, all right, thanks for the brownies. See you later. And you're right. Now, to your first point, the other thing that came to my mind, there's a great meme that's out there that there's a dog sitting on the couch, and you know, he says, because of my barking, we've never been attacked by mailman or by, you know, all these things that have happened. My family is safe because of my barking. But I mean, that sort of happens, saying, hey, the church is not impacting my life because I'm keeping them at bay by doing all this stuff, when really this stuff doesn't mean anything. And your first point about complex PTSD, I think, was an interesting one. I just want to repeat it for the recording, which is, you gave a really interesting point, which is, in Mormon theology, we don't necessarily have the promise of salvation in this life. We are left not knowing what God's thoughts are about us, as you say, until the end. So you can be in this constant state of worry, and that's the way I was as a member, that you never really know if you're doing enough. You never really know, and what you're saying is that can itself can manifest complex PTSD for people both inside and outside the church, and you suggest we look it up.
The ultimate punishment of God is he takes away the things you love.
Right. Excellent point. I left out is the ultimate point. The ultimate punishment from God is you can lose everything you love. He can take away all the relationships, withhold everything, and that in and of itself can cause PTSD and these sort of symptoms. So thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if this is going to ring a bell with anybody else, but for me, part of my PTSD is that for years, even before my faith crisis, I have always felt like the members of the church are too involved in each other's lives, and that the church grows to great pains to break down boundaries and get involved in people's business that they really don't need to be involved in. And so for me, part of this hypervigilance for me is simply not being able to even get away from them and set a boundary and say, I don't want to be involved, I'm done. I have children that moved 2 weeks ago. They'd been moved for 3 days, and I got an email from the church asking me where they were. I was livid. And, you know, to me, they don't know how to respect boundaries.
So the point was on boundary and boundary keeping, which I think is interesting because it goes two ways, but that the church oftentimes encourages people to sort of manage each other from the sides, to watch out and to be influenced. I had an anthropology class as an undergraduate when I was doing a semester at Weber State, and the guy was not a Mormon, and he was talking about the week before he was at the polling station for the election. And there was a woman who was at the polling station, too. And he said, somebody came in and said, hey, Sally, we missed you at church Sunday. He said, somebody else came in and said, hey, Sally, we missed you at church. He said, he saw five people do that to her at the polling station. He said, as an anthropologist, suddenly a light went off that, whoa, there is a huge... He said, I never realized how much social control there was going on here in this community. And as an outsider, he really saw it. So, you know, you're talking about how that can be troublesome. When you leave the church and suddenly you have all these people who you might have seen as friends now become a threat. You don't know when they're approaching your step. Is it because you guys were friends or are they after something else? And that can manifest out in a real way. I tell ex-Mormons all the time, the number one thing you can do to make your life happy when you leave the church is move. You don't have to move out of the state. You just need to move out of the stake. Because once you do, they will know you as an inactive Mormon or as a non-Mormon and they will leave you the hell alone. They because they don't have any context of you being anything else. And oftentimes, the fact is that you can't be processed as saying, oh, this guy wasn't the bishopric, and now he sits out and drinks PBR on his front porch. Well, they just can't process that change. But Mormons are fantastic people in the right context. And if you move in and drink PBR on the porch, they might be patronizing to you, but they'll be friendly to you. But the same thing goes in reverse, I'll point out, that there are individuals who, I've heard their stories, that they leave the church and suddenly everything goes quiet. So suddenly they thought, I had all these friends here and now no one will talk to me. And that could be just as disruptive because you suddenly, now anybody who approaches you, is a potential threat. Because I thought these people were friends, but now they're not. So you get wary of any sort of interaction with individuals. Go ahead.
Much of what we're seeing here is actual processing of actual either trauma, complex PTSD, etc. I mean, it's sort of like saying, well, you've got a rape abuse, you know, support group over here, and they just can't stop talking about how terrible men are to them, how bad their rape was. And I have to think, you know, I was involved in postmormon.org like 2005 or 2007 as a moderator.
What was your handle?
Luniverse.
Oh, yeah. I never could come up with a handle. It was John Larson. I was uncreative.
So we noticed, we were really huge nerds back then. So we actually developed like this, the stages of processing ex-Mormonism. And it was very unscientific. But we were like, it's about 2 years. There's kind of an average of 2 years. We watch people come in here. The first they go to the mad boards, RFN. And they're like, and then they're like, okay, we're tired of the negativity, and then they sort of graduate to postmormon.org, and then they're all kind of, they're mad sometimes, but then it's more of a social support or intellectualizing. And then two years later, they're gone. We never see them again. First me, 2 years later, I'm gone. Scares me back again, obviously. But I drop in there every once in a while. I only recognize, like, maybe lot of these, sure, some ex-Mormons, they do it. They're mad forever. I think a lot of people, they're mad for a couple of years. They work it out of their system. They process their trauma. And then, so what do you think about that?
Well, you have two interesting things, and I agree. I use the two-year time frame too. You were talking about how observing people in these online communities, that there's like this two-year where they go through the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, basically, these anger and then all that sort of stuff. I think that's absolutely true. Now, you bring up a very important point in your first comment, which you're talking about, like, communities that are survivors of, say, rape. And, of course, they're going to talk about those things all the time. What I think is interesting is the community forms from the trauma of the individuals. And I believe that there are people in the ex-Mormon community who have suffered real trauma, but not all of them. And that's what I think is interesting here. It would be as if you have a group of let's say a women's group, where there's 20 women, three of whom have suffered real trauma and rape, and the others have not. But the discussion suddenly becomes dominated by that, and then it takes on that role. So what, to extend my metaphor, that when everybody goes to the group, they all consider themselves rape victims, but when they leave the group, they don't. And that's what I'm really trying to get at. I know there's real PTSD and real trauma out there, and I'm not trying to disparage that at all. Those individuals need help on an individual basis. But what worries me sometimes is we make the situation worse than it needs to be because we take on the identity of victimhood in some ways that are overblown because the community itself has the identity of victimhood. And if we could find ways to move away from that, we might be able to form more healthy communities. Yes, ma'am.
As a community, I moderate Mormon Stories. And there's a lot of anger going on all the time. But if you suggest even like this much, that maybe eventually they will move out of anger, or maybe like when they're in it, that's not okay. Like, they're going to be pissed forever. That's their plan. They hate everyone. They hate every Mormon, everything. They're mad, and they plan to be mad forever. So do you just kind of let them do it for their 2 years? Or do you help them, like, is there a way to shorten down the anger period?
I famously burned down an entire group because I got tired of these behaviors, right? No, so what happens is individuals who are in their own rage state, and sometimes you can see it moderating, they are just fit to be tied, right? And any sort of coming in saying, hey, can you settle it down a little bit? They just blow up all over that. And that's what's really hard about these communities, because it's the lowest common denominator, and they set the tone. And then what happens in my group, which we didn't actually burn down, we just moved and renamed and whatever, but we were losing 30 participants a day because this particular flame war between two groups was going on. And we were losing the participants who produced good materials. So the whole group was changing. But when we shut down the angry folks, what they did for me is they immediately formed another group and recruited people in, and they started intentionally trying to burn down the board. And I don't blame them personally. I understand their pain. But it's not productive. And I think one of the reasons I'm talking here at Sunstone is this is an environment of people who are a little bit more thought conscious about this, saying, we need help with this problem, and I don't know the solution to the problem. I think I'm getting a good idea of what the symptoms are, but you know, moderating these things is a tough fight.
At least once a week someone tells me I'm just like the Mormon Church.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Have they started doxing you yet? They've done that to me. You know what doxing is?
It's a new thing
in that if people don't like what you do online, they go and find out your personal information, and then they will contact. So somebody who didn't like a moderation decision I made actually called a woman I was dating at the time. So the problem is this stuff starts bleeding over, and there's an element out there that wants to destroy people based on their public thing. So I only bring that up to say we're playing with. If you get John Dillon drunk, good luck. And have him tell you stories. He'll tell you stories that'll curl your hair about things that people do to try to take down who they see as in their way. And again, it's coming from a place of pain. They want to be validated that if they had to leave the church, it must be terrible. Help me validate that. We're out of time. Thanks
actually,
for...
We have room until 3:30 if you want to.
Oh, we have room for 3:30. Well, I'm not going anywhere else if you guys want to keep talking. Yes, sir. Oh, but... You're all. Anybody's free to go who wants. I don't want you to feel like you're a captive audience here. Go ahead.
Like what you're saying, I have a lot of friends on both liberal leaning and conservative leaning, and the particular leaning subject will come up, and they'll coalesce around it and exhibit some of the same behaviors you're talking about. Can you distinguish between what just looks like how people behave on the internet and the ex-Mormon group?
It's a great question. The question's saying, okay, John, you're pointing out these things, but we see these things manifesting in other communities. So there is some of these elements, and we've talked about the ex-Mormon community being this purely virtual manifestation, like on Facebook or other social media. But what I'm addressing is actually extending beyond where these communities come into real life. So I think you're absolutely right, and it's a huge problem. We have things of the like the online call-out culture that's becoming more and more prevalent. We have elements of this trying to destroy people personally. The guy who's known as the Minnesota dentist who killed the lion. You look at this element of this guy did what I consider to be a terribly terrible and morally reprehensible thing. But look at what people are trying to do to him. There's people who are trying to destroy his life, and we have seen those things manifest in these communities on a smaller scale, of course, but. I think you say, what's going on here? So definitely there is this lack of social grace and definite lack of social interaction rules in the internet. I can't tell you how many times people have told me, if they meet me in person, oh, you're not nearly as bad as I thought you'd be, or you're not as big of a dick as, but that's because we have rules to how we interact face to face. But when you're out there, talking into a podcast or posting online, we tend to forget. It's the same thing that happens with cars, right? People, there's this phenomenon in Utah. I'm gonna go curmudgeon mode here. Does anyone else see this? I don't remember this from 10 years ago, but let's say you're 200 yards away from a left-hand turn lane. The car behind you will pull into the middle center lane and floor it and try to get around the other cars beforehand. Now, the only reason I bring that sort of behavior up is we drive ways we would never act in person. We would never act the way we queue in cars the way we do in the bank. So I think to your point, there's an element that because these communities where an LDS ward is primarily or almost completely functionally face-to-face, and these communities have a huge virtual aspect, it encourages and allows for bad behavior. I think to my talk today, that would be an explanation of why hypervigilance gets so bad, but it doesn't really explain where it comes from in the first place. It's just the mechanism of the internet flames it up. It sort of stokes the flame and makes it worse and worse and worse, in my view. Yes, sir.
I lost my testimony of Mormonism. I was a BYU professor at the time, and that was not easy. And ended up losing a 37-year marriage, Mormon daughter who's disowned me. I lost my entire sense of reality, normalcy, and identity. And it was like watching my own death and trying to figure out how to resurrect from all that ash. And part of it my own fault because I didn't always handle things well. I mean, that was a hell of a lot to go through while being employed at BYU and trying to find a way to lie in typical recommend interviews so I could answer what they want to hear but still be in integrity of my own self. It was rough. And, but I was committed to healing, and I am still committed to healing because I think it's important that there are those who are angry in this community because it gives people permission to be angry because you know there's a hell of a lot to be angry about. And anger is a good place to be, it's not a good place to stay. And so it's important that we have people that allow, that could give permission to be angry, but it's also important that we have people in this community that give you permission to be okay again.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate those that are providing both models. Especially with what you're doing.
Yeah, I think you have a fantastic point, and it's one that, if you're familiar with my body of work, I hammer more and more and more. The realization that we talk about all these little facts and factoids and things about the church and the Book of Mormon and faith and all that kind of stuff, that stuff really doesn't matter. What really matters is identity. And the real struggle that ex-Mormons go through is a search for identity. And as you point out, you tell your story about being a BYU professor and losing all these things. It's hard to explain to people how traumatic it is to have these structures just fall away. And it's sort of like I'm single. So when I talk to my married friends and say, oh, you can go sleep with whoever you want, or you can go do, you know, on a Friday night, you can do whatever, you don't have to. Yeah, but the lack of, like, structure and not having, you know, somebody who you can come home from work with and just say, you know, I had a hard day, and they say, oh, let's just go watch Netflix and eat popcorn. There's these elements of security that I shape our identity. And when you lose those, it might sound like you're a kid in paradise, but you're not. Human beings don't function well without good boundaries, in my view. And it's really, really hard. Our culture is so permissive. I'm a libertine. I like a permissive culture. But it can be really hard psychologically when you have to establish all those things yourself. And unfortunately, to this point, on that edge, that first 2 years, it comes out as a lot of anger and a lot of looking for, talking about Monson having Alzheimer's. You know, it comes out that way. Yes, ma'am. Yes, I think I did that one in Phoenix, right?
I don't remember.
No, I did that one in Portland, in a bar, yeah.
And it was just my husband and myself and six kids have been out 17 months now. And so we're just really in that, okay, we were ready to move on. We've really done the anger thing really well for 5 months. And then we, instead of just moving out of the state, we just left the country for a year. And I would highly recommend that because it makes Mormonism really come into perspective when you're on the other side of the world. But the ex, how to become an ex Mormon was just, if anyone here hasn't listened to that one, go listen.
Well, thanks. Her comment was, I recorded a podcast a year or two ago called How to Become an XX Mormon, and which is really talking about this transformation. And a lot of those points are what we talked about here. Go find a new identity. And I think what I'd add, I don't remember exactly what I said there, but what I'd add is you can give yourself permission to be angry. This is hard to do. And especially when you're surrounded by a community that thinks you're just screwing around. You're just dinking off. And then you oftentimes don't have the support to say, this is really, really tough to reshape your own identity, especially if you've been in the church a long time. I haven't done any research other than watching, and you can look around this room. The demographic for leaving the church is generally between the ages of 30 and 50. I think because below 30, especially below 24, your prefrontal cortex is not formed and fully, and changing your identity is a lot easier. Your identity starts getting locked in, and after a certain age, the social cost of leaving becomes so high that it's just not worth pursuing. So I think there's this golden time frame when people do it, but it's a really difficult process to go through. I can't. And I know sometimes in these talks, and the one I gave earlier, I can be really flip about the ex-Mormon community. I mean, I my heart goes out to all these folks that this is just really hard stuff. Anything else? All right, thanks everybody for your patience. Thank you.